This is the one with a giant centipede policeman.
And the Sisterhood of Khan!
A sequel to The Brain of Morbius.
With a crazed madman trying to resurrect a crazed madman.
While some crazed women try to kill a madman with a box.
It's called Sisters of the Flame.
Here.
And it's called The Vengeance of Morbius.
We go.
Reviewing audiobooks now too, cause we love our Doctor Who.
Encountering we're in Tarmadark, Dalek, Spacetime, and Glam Rock.
Starlet phones are awful, that's the TARDIS way.
We're a punk in a Mary's Kane.
That's Kane with a K. Who back when? Reviewing all the poo there is.
Who back when? Subscribe and rate on iTunes please.
Audiobook by audiobook, even those are gobbledygook.
We'll review them all you see, so join us on this odyssey.
It's Who back when?
Who back when?
Hello, and welcome to episode A13 of Who Back When, a Doctor Who podcast. I am Ponkin, and who are you again?
I'm not Ponkin.
Always foiling my plans to, yes, you are you, and you are JD. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm joined by JD. How awesome is this? Guess what we have in store for you tonight, or today. Let's not discriminate. You may be listening to this first thing in the morning. We've got a double episode special feature for you. We're going to go through Sisterhood of the Flame. We're going to go through Vengeance of Morbius, that's what it's called.
And it is the season 2 finale of the 8th Doctor Adventures.
Yeah, and holy Jesus, what a spectacularly bombastic double feature.
Well, yes, it came back after the Zygon, the Feltworth.
Oh, that's true.
Which was last week.
You're right, maybe it's just sort of based on the sheer contrast between Zygon and Sisterhood. Maybe that's why I'm feeling very enthused about this double feature, but it doesn't matter. We're going to see. Let's just see what happens. Shall we jump into Bite Size?
Yes, let's have a bite-sized chunk of Who.
Bite-sized chunk of Who.
The Eighth Doctor and Lucy suddenly find themselves adrift in space and time, as the TARDIS has apparently up and died on them, just as a giant black hole approaches with the express interest to gobble them up.
No need to panic, though, as it's just a Time Lord ploy to bring them back to Gallifrey. Turns out, you see, there's a crazy magnate bonkers person out there named Zarodnix, who's on the lookout for a Time Lord of his own.
And the reason he needs a Time Lord is so that he will be able to completely Jurassic Park a brand new regeneration of formerly alive and murdering dictator and Time Lord Morbius.
That's episode 2, though. First, the Doc and Luce need to be split up, encounter the Sisterhood of Khan, as well as a whole bunch of bionic centipedes. And that concludes the bite-sized chunk of Who.
You are welcome.
Aren't you just?
Seriously, before we jump into this, we've had a lot of two-parters so far. I think this must be the third one we've had.
Is it the third one?
Blood of the Daleks, Human Resources.
Oh, yes. I keep forgetting about Blood of the Daleks.
And so far, they've been all quite successful, and this one is not going to buck that trend, to be honest.
No. Yeah, spoiler alert. Yeah, I absolutely love this one.
So, we begin, as we tend to begin, in the TARDIS.
Yes, we do.
They're off on their travels, and then, basically, everything goes black.
Yeah, and the Doc basically says he can always sense when the TARDIS is alive, like he can feel its heartbeat, essentially, but at this point it seems as though it is just completely lifeless. And we get a tiny little bit of exposition here, which, this is one of the few qualms I have about this episode. It's very ham-fisted. The exposition is essentially Lucy asking, is that even possible? Like, could it suddenly be drained of all of its life energy? And the Doctor goes, yes, well, I mean, the only possibility would be if the Eye of Harmony never existed and only someone with a stellar manipulator could shut down the Eye. And that's it. That's just like a little parenthesis, and I really wonder if that's going to come into play in a little bit.
Well, this is the first of our extreme continuity points.
Yeah.
That is in this episode. there will be a lot of them.
Okay.
We'll start off with the Eye of Harmony, which is the power source of the TARDIS, which has been mentioned a number of times. Most recently in Journey to the Center of the TARDIS with Matt Smith, where the Eye of Harmony is actually in the TARDIS. Then you had going back in time to the very, very first Paul McGann story, the TV movie, where the Eye of Harmony was also in the TARDIS, but it could only be opened by a human eye for no apparent reason.
Human, as in human?
As in human, not humanoid.
Okay.
That is actually explained away, because bear in mind at the time, that was like everyone thought was a continuity error and what the hell's going on, but is explained away in an absolutely brilliant Sixth Doctor adventure with Colin Baker and Evelyn Smythe. It is incredibly good, but we'll leave that until we get to it.
Yeah, we're going to get to that at some point. By the way, yes, full disclosure, I still haven't seen the McGann movie.
Who really should? But prior to that, Invasion of Time, traveling back to the Tom Baker era, the Eye of Harmony is actually stationed on Gallifrey, and that powers all the TARDISes from Gallifrey. So there's been a lot of continuity around the Eye of Harmony. It's shifted about a bit. The Stellar Manipulator, which they've been talking about. And he says there was only ever one Stellar Manipulator and it doesn't exist anymore. That was the Hand of Omega, which was brought to Earth by William Hartnell's Doctor, and it was picked up again by Sylvester McCoy's Doctor, and it was left in a graveyard near Totter's Lane, and you find all of that out in Remembrance of the Daleks in The Seventh Doctor.
I am not worthy. I bow to your superior knowledge. That was fantastic. Hang on, sorry, are you saying that there is literally no reference to it between Hartnell and Sylvester McCoy?
No, there's no reference to it in Hartnell. It was backronymed in at that point.
Oh, I see.
It was in...
Good word, by the way.
In Remembrance of the Daleks, it was mentioned that he brought it to Shoreditch in London when he was here the last time, which was in 1963 when he was here with Susan, Ian and Barbara. Basically, he stole the Stellar Manipulator from Gallifrey.
Okay.
And stuck it on Earth.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
So he stuck it there as Hartnell, and then the first time it was ever mentioned was in McCoy.
Okie dokie. Thank you very much. Shall we press on with the plot?
We can do. There'll be a lot of these. So let's continue. This is just chock full of continuity. So for those listeners that haven't actually listened to it, I shall try and explain as we're going along.
By the way, obviously I saw it as a kid. I have not seen it again since then. What about Brain of Morbius?
Oh, we will get on to this.
Okay.
We will get on to Brain of Morbius when Morbius turns up.
All right, good. I look forward to that. In the meantime, though, all of a sudden, as though out of nowhere, this massive black hole pops up, blammo, and it starts pulling them in, and the Doc IDs it as, quote, a particularly nasty piece of Time Lord technology.
He does indeed, and we don't even know what it is yet.
Yeah, but because...
But it is coming straight for them.
Yeah, but the reason we don't find out any more about it is because, fortunately, they make good their escape, and all of a sudden they rematerialize somewhere, and they exit the TARDIS to find out where they are. Bada bing, bada boom, they are aboard a space freighter, but they don't really get to enjoy the show or the scenery very much, because all of a sudden, a bunch of massive bionic centipedes appears and attacks. Is that a bunch of centipedes, by the way? Is it a flock of centipedes? A school of centipedes? A murder of centipedes?
It's a something of... I don't know. It'd be, you know, a feat of centipedes?
Oh, nice. I like it.
Yeah.
Anyway, cut to an employee...
Cutscene.
Yes. So then we have a cutscene where an employee of the so-called Mr. Zorodniks is confirming to the Big Z that they have found their objective. And Zorodniks, when he hears this, he practically sings. He is so maniacal. Every single time that he seems very enthused about something, when he's exalted, he just goes into crazy bonkers mode.
He spends a lot of time in the next two episodes being crazy bonkers.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Right, we don't have a prior Doctor Who connection for Zorodniks, sadly. Mm-hmm. But we do have a prior science fiction connection.
Do tell.
Zorodniks is played by someone called Kenneth Coley, and he played Admiral Piet in The Empire Strikes Back and The Return of the Jedi.
No way!
Yes.
This is fantastic.
And if you go to whobackwhen.com, you shall see screenshots of Kenneth Coley.
Yes, you shall.
So,
mental note to add those in.
Meanwhile.
Meanwhile, we jump from one cutscene to another, because what we now get to listen in on is someone else who works for Zari, space dialing 911 and chatting with Police Marshal Rostow of the Trell, who is played by Holy Jesus Christmas Balls, Alexander Siddig.
Who, as you know, was Julian Bashir from DS9. This is not the only audiobook that he has been in.
Oh, really?
Either. He's in some others.
Oh, nice!
And he also has a tenuous, slightly, Doctor Who connection via his wife.
Oh, really? Who is she?
Nana Visitor, who played Major Kira Nerys from DS9.
Wait, hang on. Wait. Nana Visitor and Alexander Siddig are married?
Yes.
Oh, wow. I just got a Star Trek boner. That is fantastic.
Well, we're married.
Oh, I'm sorry. Hey, guys, if you're listening, I'm sorry it didn't work out.
Obviously, he was also married to Nana Visitor, who guest starred in Torchwood.
Oh, really?
Yes.
God damn it. I don't remember these things. My mind is like a sieve. You could use it to strain pasta with. Anyway.
No, well, basically, most people have starred in either Doctor Who or Torchwood. She played Olivia Colsanto in Torchwood Miracle Day, a couple of episodes of that.
Okay, I remember Miracle Day. Anyway, so Rosto is now asking for a name for a stowaway, and finds out this person is called Lucy Miller. He Googles her name, essentially space Googles her, and is flummoxed, essentially, from square one, because there are zero hits for Lucy Miller. Which I find rather odd, by the way. In the infinity of space and time, there is only one person with that name. Because it's not like, hey, can you send over her DNA code and I'll Google that. It's like, I will Google her name. One of the most common English names. One person. And she doesn't even exist. In fact, that's it.
She's been at many, many points in history. So exactly. You would imagine she would. And considering this is in the future, considering what she does for the rest of the next two seasons, she would be everywhere.
Okay. Yeah, don't spoil it. Don't spoil it. Don't spoil it. I still haven't heard the next one. I still haven't heard what follows series three.
Orbis. So, Lucy is in a cell.
Yes, she is.
So, at this point, I'm thinking, we've missed a scene here. So I go back and listen to it and realise we haven't. basically, Lucy starts screaming, and she doesn't stop screaming when she doesn't really like a 10-foot caterpillar coming in to talk to her.
Yeah, and it's not just that she's being maybe a tiny little bit racist, it's that she is... we didn't actually find out about this before. We mentioned it, but we didn't actually find out about it before. Now we find out that the creatures that attacked and, well, split up her and the dog, they were the exact same kind of centipede people. Trell, they're called. But also, Lucy should be going a little bit bonkers because she has spent approximately 2 days in this cell without any sleep and also stewing in her own fecal-stained clothes because she's been hiding in sewage. We have yet another Doctor Who reference to people and sewage and the weird relationship the companions appear to have with waste. Anyway, Rosto essentially starts interrogating her.
Yeah, and Rosto and Lucy actually make a really good couple, even though Lucy's a bit antagonistic at the time.
Kind of what really warms her heart to him. If she had been completely nonplussed about Rosto in the first place, then there's no contrast, there's no reason to go anywhere exciting from that. But because she's quite racist to begin with, you're calling him stuff like, oh, you overgrown centipede, or you bug, or whatever it is.
Yeah, huge big bug.
Yeah, exactly. When she then realizes, oh, maybe I was a little bit harsh, she probably feels a little bit bad and tries to overcompensate. And thanks to that, they build this amazing friendship. Over a very short period of time, by the way.
Yeah, but, this, I think, is slightly out of character for Lucy. She questions basically everything. So she says, "Is a bug.
Yeah.
Why can't you hire proper human police?" So Lucy says, "Oh, can I speak to someone human instead?"
Yeah.
And Lucy then says, "Well, better talk to a human than one of your lot." And this is for Lucy, who has spent, two seasons travelling through space and time and seeing the Tarmadoc on the back of Vortasaur's riding in. This is for Lucy, oddly racist.
Okay.
It is incredibly racist for Lucy.
It is very racist.
Who wasn't racist to the Daleks.
Yeah. But dude, Meister, I don't know if I completely agree. I mean, yes, it is racist, but it is... I imagine that if an oddly friendly Dalek were to turn up, she would treat it with the same kind of, suspicion. In this case, she's only just 2 days prior been attacked by centipedes, and now all of a sudden another centipede turns up and says that he's a good guy. This is the reason she's suspicious, but...
Yeah, but she doesn't come across as suspicious. She doesn't come across as antagonistic. She comes across as purely racist.
Okay.
You know, it's... If she'd have been grumpy and shouting at him and, you know, all of that sort of thing, I would understand completely. Mm-hmm. But it's actual just racism, in my opinion.
Okay, fair enough, yeah. Okay, all right. Anyway, as he is interrogating her, he says he's recording the whole thing. She now tells him what happened, and the way that we get this is through a flashback. So we find out they materialize, they realize that they're aboard a space freighter of some description, then all of a sudden Kablamatron, all these bionic centipedes turn up, attack, and separate them, like they kidnap the Doctor. He tells Lucy, oh, run for your life. She runs off and Shawshank style hides in some sewage pipes. And that's it. 2 days later, she's now talking to Rosto of the Trail.
But she does explain that they looked similar to Rosto, but not identical.
Yeah, exactly, because they were like the $6 million centipedes. Like, they were bionic, whereas Rosto is just purely organic.
And probably wearing a police uniform with a nice badge. Sort of NYPD of space. And then, you know, Rosto...
Oh, he also... Sorry, hang on. One important detail. She also remembers seeing a humanoid female.
But didn't see the humanoid female's face.
Exactly.
And, you know, Rosto now, very politely and very courteously to Lucy, says, thank you for all of that. I'm going to go
and CSI the crime scene.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think, ultimately, he's being a very polite, very nice cop.
Yeah.
I think you were going to
jump to the next plot point. I think there's something else that we need to mention here. You're going to be more of an expert. But we get an EDA first. We get a soundbite from a different audiobook. We get a soundbite from the end of Dead London.
Which is never a good sign.
Yeah, but why? It seems so strange to plonk a bit of Dead London in there. And it's just as, like, she's remembering and missing the Doctor. And as she does so, we hear the whole, like, oh, what's that up there? Oh, I was expecting to see a blue moon. Blah, blah, blah. We're listening to a really good audiobook here, Big Finish. Don't remind us of the fact that you've also made crap. Anyway,
yeah,
let's continue.
Dead London is... not brilliant.
Yeah.
That's the world's biggest understatement.
Yeah.
So, anyway, Rosto goes and CSIs.
Yeah.
And he records it very kindly for us listeners in both Trell and Human.
Yeah. Thank you, Rosto. That's very kind of you.
He says that the Trell are a peaceful race. They mm-hmm. are very kind centipedes.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't think that her story is quite true. But he does start checking for anything which could support her story or say her story is completely false.
Yeah.
So he's being quite unbiased at this point. He is being a very good police officer.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And we should actually say this. He is so calm. Like, this is the most zen caterpillar I have ever heard speak English.
You know, Alexander Siddig does an amazing job as Rosto.
Yeah.
It's one of those where I'd like him to turn up again because Rosto's really nice.
Yeah, I agree. Anyway, so then we hear what sounds like a TARDIS arriving, but it is in fact a time ring. And the last time we heard a time ring was Human Resources, correct me if I'm wrong?
Absolutely correct. And, you know, she's very happy because the Doctor's turned up, and then she becomes incredibly pissed because instead of the Doctor, it is the return of Nicholas Grace as Straxus from Human Resources.
What an arsehole.
And he's back.
Yeah.
Being an arsehole.
Yeah. And let's speed through that bit. He basically just turns up, tells Lucy in so many words that she's a primitive. He was looking for the Doctor, but oh, right, so he was already taken 2 days ago. Well, he must have just missed his mark by a couple of days then. He's going to go back to Gallifrey and then try again.
Lucy asks whether she can go because she's in a cell. She doesn't want to be in a cell.
Yeah.
But he says, well, I'd forgotten what a completely unpleasant person you are. And anyway, lesser species aren't allowed to go to Gallifrey.
Yeah.
Now, that line, the comment that lesser species are not allowed to go to Gallifrey
mm-hmm.
Was the reason given by Tom Baker's Doctor for not taking Sarah Jane Smith there. When Elizabeth Sladen was leaving the show,
yeah,
the next episode had the Doctor going to Gallifrey. And the reason why the Doctor got rid of possibly his best ever companion in yeah. Sarah Jane Smith was that he was not allowed to take a lesser species to Gallifrey.
Man, those Time Lords are racist.
They are. And then the Doctor, the next time he went to Gallifrey, completely broke it by taking Leela there.
Ah.
And leaving her there. But, you know, but yeah, they are. The Time Lords are incredibly racist, even more than Lucy was earlier. So Lucy asks Straxus, you know, why? Why have they actually come here for the Doctor?
Mm-hmm.
He exposites that something's terrible's happening and she's due to just sit in the corner. And then he leaves.
Yeah, talk about leaving on a cliffhanger. Something terrible is happening in the universe. And he also adds, don't trust anyone, Lucy Miller. Like, what? And then he just dematerializes. What a total Time Lord douchebag.
Yes. There's a lot more stronger words than douchebag. Here, Straxus is just completely dislikable. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, at the moment, anyway.
Well, even in his last
episode.
I didn't like Straxus in Human Resources either. He was incompetent.
I didn't like him there either. I was thinking of the next one.
Oh, you're thinking of later on. Okay.
Yeah, spoiler alert. Anyway.
Cut back to Horatio Kane, the centipede version.
Yeah.
And basically, he's found that there are two DNA traces that don't match anyone that should be here.
Yeah.
As well as Lucy Miller's.
Yeah, exactly.
So indicating that maybe Lucy was right.
Yeah, he's also found evidence of some sort of bionic enhancement as well, right?
Yes. So basically what happens is that he sort of completely changes his opinion of Lucy's story because he's now got evidence.
Yeah.
And then decides to go and talk to Lucy again. So again, he's level and balanced.
Yeah, likable guy. Anyway, we cut back to the cell where some really, really gorgeous sounding woman named Hespera has now appeared. And Lucy quite, I think, reasonably assumes that she is the human or humanoid police marshal that Dr. Bashir was going to summon. And Hespera, in fact, confirms this. She said, yes, I happen to be in the area and now I'm here. You know what? Let's go. Let's not care about that centipede guy. And they kind of have this weird racist bonding moment.
We are totally going all BNP on centipedes right now.
Oh, yeah. If you have more than two legs, I'm sorry, but...
Yeah, it's Animal Farm. Two legs bad, four legs good. You know, and it's they are bonding over their hatred of Rostow.
Yeah.
And sadly, it's going to go all Galaxy 4 in a moment.
Even though there is actually a one-liner there that I did give a little bit of a chuckle to. It's when Lucy says something to the effect of, oh, he's... Like, where is Rostow? Oh, he's probably having a very long session with his chiropractor or something like that.
Which, I must admit, is a good line.
It is a good...
But we, you know...
But it is terrible, and Who Back When does not condone racism towards centipedes. Boom. Done. We said it.
But...
Yeah.
A beautiful woman has, in fact, come into Lucy's cell. Yeah. It is a female character.
I wonder, is there any kind of actor or actress trivia pertaining to this female character in a Doctor Who audiobook?
Yes, there is.
You know what? We should maybe consult the statistics. Is there some sort of pattern? Like, if there's a female character, like, who normally plays her, JD? Would you say that there's some sort of pattern here?
There is normally a pattern, yes. And this is a female character that's come into the story, and it's not played by Catriona Olsen.
What?
it's actually played by a lady called Nicola Weeks, who is not Catriona Olsen, and that is the Who trivia about Hespera.
Has she done anything else?
No, she's done another. She does these two audiobooks and another one called The Mind's Eye, and that's
okay.
it.
Okay,
but yes, it's a female character not played by Catriona Olsen, which in itself
is
a good bit of Who trivia.
Yeah, that should be one of the weird Doctor Who tropes that we should be tracking. I'm really sorry, by the way, for still not having implemented a trope tracking system on the website. It will calm people. Anyway, so they then essentially head off, because Hespera says, yeah, she's read Rostow's report, she's totally on Lucy's side, and she suggests that they go to the nearest Earth embassy from which or where they can issue this sort of galaxy-wide bolo on the Dockmeister. And so off they go. And then, bada-bing, Straxus materializes on Gallifrey, and we now get to hear what the Gallifreyan atmosphere sounds like. He's chatting with another Time Lord, Coordinator Bulek, who tells him that due to the Time Scoop, which, by the way, that was the black hole that we encountered in the very beginning, and due to the fact that Mr. Zed is dabbling in Time Lordery, the Time Ring is the safest form of travel. And we get this fantastic little bit here where, what's his face again, Straxus, is saying that it's undignified. Like, it's essentially as though he's traveling around in a really rusty Fiat from who knows when. It's fantastic. Actually, I love Fiats. I don't even know why I said that. But it's a fun little bit of banter.
And then we get Bula, Straxus turning around and going, well, the Doctor had already gone, but I spoke to the really irritating companion, and...
Yeah, and
well,
Bula goes, wait, what the fuck? Why did you leave her there? Why is she not here with you?
But she's a very irritating woman.
Yes, but she... But listen to me, Straxus, she is the greatest lead that we have in order to find the Doctor. You must bring her back.
Straxus is really thick.
He's such an idiot.
So basically, we also find out that Zardodnix is trying to get hold of the Doctor.
Yeah.
So Bulik sends Straxus back again and completely 12 monkeys him back in time to go and find the Doctor.
Yeah. And but we got to
also say Coordinator Bulik also mentions that the time scoop is active.
Yeah.
That was one of the things he mentions. And the time scoop...
Yeah, I said so. It's the black hole.
Yeah, but it is a Doctor Who bit of trivia.
Oh! Go for it.
The time scoop is the main plot device in The Five Doctors, and it was basically a massively unauthorized bit of Time Lord technology that could suck anyone from space and time and bring them to the planet that the time scoop was used on. I'm done with the trivia.
Okie dokie. Shall we, what do you say? Shall we cut back to Hospira's mega luxurious spaceship?
Oh, yes. Lucy is a bit shocked that the superbly well-appointed spaceship is actually a police car.
Yeah.
Which, to be fair, having been in police cars, that's actually a very valid thing that Lucy has said here.
Yeah, I'm imagining this massive, palatial, super luxurious Winnebago. Essentially a limousine that you can live your entire life in.
So now, we basically get Lucy having flashbacks to 30 minutes ago. And basically wondering, well, why Straxus was there and why the people who kidnapped the Doctor knew that the TARDIS would turn up and who was the woman. And...
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say, like, she's having this weird moment where she out loud expresses all of her suspicions in front of this weird humanoid female who suddenly turned up. She goes,
I wonder who the woman could be.
Yeah, have a look around, Lucy. There really aren't that many suspects. Anyway, so Lucy then goes off to bed, and while she is drifting off to Sleepyland, we hear a female voice chanting, "Sacred Flame.
Sacred Fire."
Over and over again, like whoever it is trying to put like a Telly Savalas of on Her Majesty's Secret Service, but then blam, there's an explosion on board.
Lucy runs back to the bridge and she sees a Trell turning up.
Not just any Trell.
Oh no, it's our Trell.
Yeah, it's Dr. Bashir. And he basically goes, listen, it's your old pal Rosto. That chick is not a cop. We now find out he never wrote a report. Well, he says so anyway. He never made a call to ask for a humanoid or human marshal to replace him. Long story short, Hospira is full of shit. And he has one tiny little piece of evidence, which is sort of the final piece that he needs to prove that she is full of shit. And it is an ear stud. Now, there is something I'm sure we're coming up to it or I've left it out, but somehow, Lucy has got hold of a laser gun. That's my note here. When did she get a gun? All of a sudden, she has a gun.
Yes, all of a sudden, she has a gun.
Yeah, where did that gun come from?
No, I have no idea where the gun comes from either.
Okay, presumably she just picked it up somewhere, like as in the luxury Winnebago.
Well, no, I'm imagining that the gun is on the bridge, and okay. It's a Hasperia's gun.
Okay.
But Hasperia can't get to the gun because there's a 100-footed guy in the way.
Okay, fair enough.
And so Lucy is picking up Hasperia's gun. That's the only real explanation I can give to Lucy having a gun.
Yeah. Okay, fine. So there is actually a little bit of a funny scene here as well, because she's holding the gun, she's holding both of them at gunpoint, and she's saying, like, listen, no one move, let's go through this slowly and methodically, and I won't kill you. And at the end of this, I will choose sides, basically. And as she's saying this, kablamo, accidentally, she, like, Pulp Fictions the gun, and it accidentally goes off. Fortunately, she doesn't blow anyone's brains out, but it accidentally goes off. And there's this really funny moment where both Dr. Bashir and Hospira go, okay, are you, can we calm down a little bit now? It's got a very, very sensitive trigger, Lucy.
Rosto turns around and goes, I found this ear stud. Look, Hospira is only wearing one and the other one's missing.
Yeah.
I
really don't feel like that should be enough to convince Lucy, by the way.
Well, one, it weirdly isn't. What happens next is, which is where her spirit takes out the other ear stud, offers to give it to Lucy, and then throws it down and it's a smoke grenade.
Yeah, which is awesome. We've got this weird James Bond ear stud. Could maybe we're mistaken. Maybe it's not the ear stud. Because she is part of the Sisterhood of Teleporting Pants. Maybe it's like some sort of weird sisterhood magic that she's doing in order to conjure up the smoke. It might not be the ear stud.
No, it's an ear grenade stud.
Oh, God damn it. I'm really wishing and hoping that we're wrong and that it's not a James Bond ear stud. Anyway, she now disappears. And as she's disappearing, we hear the whole sacred flame, sacred fire thing again.
And Hesperia basically teleports away. Lucy agrees that Rosto is actually the right person to trust here.
Yeah.
And then we sort of Dempsey and Makepeace into Hesperia's cabin, and they start trying to find where this magical teleporting thing is.
Yeah, but they don't find anything, and thus they conclude, okay, so... Oh, wait, no, hang on. They conclude later on what happened there. Let's not jump ahead. Anyway... We now cut to where Hespera is rematerializing, and she's meeting this elderly woman named Orthina, who is essentially pulling a coordinator Bulik at this point, because she is reprimanding her for leaving Lucy behind. And it turns out these ladies, they are after the Doc as well, and everything that even remotely associated with him must be destroyed, including Lucy.
Orthina is a female in... a Doctor Who audio play.
Oh, really? Who's playing Orthina?
Oh, it's Catriona Olsen!
Woohoo! Yay.
Yeah, can't go an entire episode. She's contractually still holding Nicholas Briggs in the bondage cupboard. If you don't let me in this, I shall put the pictures of you in the gimp mask.
Up on my little Tumblr blog. Someone please get Catriona's bondagecupboard.tumblr.com. Anyway. So we cut back to Rosto and company. He's reached the conclusion that Lucy is actually not half bad and probably telling the truth. He tells us as much as well. And he says their first order of business is to locate the $6 million trail and find out who this Hespera is. And thus, Lucy starts examining the ear stud, as in the one that he found, and on it is a flame logotype, so they decide to space goof it.
And at this point, Lucy apologizes to Rosto.
Oh, yeah. No, that's very good point. Yeah, yeah.
And she feels incredibly guilty about being racist.
Yeah, she says that. She uses the word racist.
Yeah, she does. And, you know, Rosto, in a level-headed person that he is, says, yes, it's because you were scared, and I understand. And he's like, this guy would make a perfect companion. He really would. Apart from probably wouldn't fit through the door of the TARDIS.
Yeah.
So, Lucy suggests looking it up on the internet, and Rosto thinks, I don't know what this internet is, but we have a Galactinet.
You know what? I think maybe we should even soundbite the explanation of what this is. Would anyone out in podcast land like to hear a Dr. Bashir soundbite?
I would.
Soundbites.
Soundbites.
The Galactinet.
The Galactinet. What's that?
You've never heard of it?
Humor me.
It's a super-light microwave information network transmitted across hyperspatial transmission conduits.
Oh, is it? Sounds like the internet to me.
Come on, bug buddy. Go for it.
Excellent impersonation.
Which is Lucy's idea of being nice.
Yeah.
She's now using bug, not in a racist term.
No, in like as a diminutive.
A friendly term for us now. Anyway, cut to Zaphod Beeblebrox.
Yes, nice. That's also one of mine later on.
Basically, he discovers that his minions have lost the Doctor.
Yeah, it's now time for Zed's dead baby to get pretty dang ticked off and pull a coordinator Bulik now towards his $6 million trail. Because they're like, I'm sorry, we lost him. What do you mean you lost it? It is literally the same scene a third time yet again that we get to hear.
So far, we know that all of the major players do not have the Doctor.
Yeah.
Basically, we find out here that Hesperia must be working for the Time Lords because there's Time Lord technology around. which is, from what we know about the Sisterhood of Khan, if this audiobook isn't the only source you know about Khan, is unlikely.
Dear the Doctor?
Knight of the Doctor.
Knight of the Doctor, sorry.
Yeah, and the Doctor crashes on Khan, and Khan doesn't really like the Doctor one little bit.
No, at all.
At all. So, yeah, so it's... in the Sisterhood of Khan, they don't like the Time Lords. In the Knight of the Doctor, they don't like the Time Lords. In this, they don't like the Time Lords, but Zarodnik seems to think, yes, it's feasible.
Yeah. There is a tiny little bit of a weird, I think, continuity error here as well, which is Zed is asking his $6 million Trell, what was the name of this Time Lord that you lost? He goes, oh, it was the Doctor. He says, I've heard stories of this Doctor, but freaking Zed's dead baby is crazy. Like, he's a massive fanboy of Morbius. Shouldn't he know exactly who the Doctor is? He shouldn't all of a sudden go, I'm pretty sure I've heard that name being tossed around now and then. Like, he's kind of a semi-famous dude as far as Time Lords go.
Yes, and the person who killed Morbius.
Exactly, my point. So if he's such an incredible aficionado of Morbius, he should immediately go, no, that's the guy I want. That's the dude.
Yeah, it does seem a bit illogical that he doesn't know who the Doctor is.
Yeah.
He gets even more pissed when he learns that the Cybertrell don't have the TARDIS either, and he orders his people to start tracing the TARDIS.
Yeah, because they somehow, they have its, like, time travel signature or something.
But they don't have enough energy for the particular way that they track TARDIS.
Oh, is this the way we get the weird comical interlude of him just going totally bonkers and, like, Wall Street starts selling everything?
Yes, that's exactly what happens.
Totally crazy. He just he finds out, essentially, he doesn't have enough money to track down the TARDIS. So he goes, oh, it's fine. Sell planets, sell everything, sell this and that and every planet and galaxy and that we have. Just track down the TARDIS. He is so bonkers. Anyway.
Yeah, he's utterly crazy. So, and soon it will be time for them to have the final extraction.
Yeah.
So, wonder what that could be. Anyway, we now cutscene to Hespera, who has totally gone into the Doctor's cell and tells him to wake up.
Yeah, and also to shut up.
Which, to be fair, is a perfectly reasonable thing to say.
Yeah, and then we also cut back to Rosto giving Lucy a Galactina tutorial, and then Lucy space googling the flame symbol and finding out that it's the emblem of the Sisterhood of the Traveling Khan.
Yeah. You know, Hespera goes into the Doctor's cell.
Yeah.
Right.
That's it, right? There's not anything else.
The Doctor bothers to turn up in this episode for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
All the rest of it is Lucy.
Yeah, it's Lucy and Rostov, more or less.
Right? And so far, I haven't cared. I've mentioned this in a lot of other episodes before, which is I have a problem where they split the Doctor and Lucy up, because I have a feeling that their banter works well together.
It does, but...
And...
As does Dr. Bashir's and Lucy's.
Well, yes, but I realise that I've made a slight error in commenting on that in the past.
Okay.
It's not where they split the Doctor and Lucy up. It's where they have the Doctor on his own. The bits where Lucy is on her own work absolutely fine.
Okay, wait, hang on. Even in Dead London, where the Doctor is teamed up with, what's her name again?
Spring-Heeled Sophie.
Spring-Heeled Sophie. The split up, we get a lot of Doctor and Sophie. That works super fine.
With the exception of the audiobook is awful.
Yeah, okay, yes, admittedly, the audiobook is not a great one.
Well, I'm waiting for you to tell me all the good points you're about to say about Dead London.
The relationship, the rapport between Sophie and the Doctor is great. As in, what I'm trying to say is the Doctor can have a very good audio rapport with a character that is not Lucy.
Okay, yeah, it's a valid point. I still think Lucy's better on her own than the Doctor is, huh?
Okay, no, I think I'd probably agree with that as well. She's just sassier.
Yeah, that's true. So anyway, Rosto basically opens up Internet Explorer.
Yep.
And she Googles the ear stud.
Yeah. Bada bing, bada boom. It's the Sisterhood of Khan. We find out, okay, Zed owns Khan and allegedly has his corporate HQ there. And we learn that Zed is this businessman who just buys and sells planets and collects ancient artifacts. According to the Space Wi-Fi, the Sisterhood left Khan about 52 standard years earlier when the planet was appropriated by the Zoroastrian Corporation. situation. And no one knows where they live now. But essentially, they are this sort of bunch of lady psychics, which is enough for Dr. Bashir, as in enough of an explanation for Dr. Bashir, how Hespera disappeared. Oh, she's a lady psychic. She's part of some sort of weird magical cult. Obviously, she just Harry Potter'd her way out of the room.
Which is possible.
Yeah, but a moment ago, he didn't know anything about this group of ladies. And now it's like, oh, well, you know, they're magicians. So it makes sense. Essentially, I think what I want to contest is that we are now in 2014 on Earth, and we know quite well that everything that's on the internet is not necessarily true. However, in the future, on the Galactinet, if you're a Trell, if you read something online, it's got to be true.
There are people who think that about Wikipedia.
Okay.
So, anyway.
Yeah, let's speed, dude. Sorry.
Right, anyway, obviously, this is the first mention in this story of Khan.
Yeah.
We've mentioned it before. Khan was previously in Doctor Who on the Brain of Morbius. And no particular spoilers, because everyone that is listening to this will have seen Night of the Doctor.
Yeah.
This is where Paul McGann's Doctor will die. This is his Trenzalore.
Yeah.
He will come back here and die. And in Night of the Doctor, the woman in Night of the Doctor turns around and goes, the Doctor has returned to Khan, which we all thought was, you know, coming back from Brain and Morbius, but it's actually probably
from this.
They know him from this.
Yeah, exactly.
And which would make sense that they knew this particular regeneration of the Doctor as well.
Yeah, no, it makes perfect sense. And it ties it in very nicely, since he even mentions Lucy right before he dies.
Yes. So anyway, she starts Googling, and the Galactinet is really shit at this point, because she Googles the Time Lords, and they are a legendary race of time travellers, and that's it. You know, it is a Wikipedia stub.
Yeah.
And, you know, Rosto, for all, you know, is just a cop. He's not a time traveller. He's not Lucy Bleeding Miller, and says, well, I don't know what to do here.
Long story short, they decide, F it, let's go to Khan.
Yeah, which is the perfectly reasonable thing to do at this point.
Yeah. Blammo, cut to Khan, where Zed's people have noticed that Hespera's ship is approaching. Cut back to the ship, Rosto has checked the news, found that Zed's been buying a bunch of Trell planets, and they sort of, as they're approaching the planet, they hypothesize, or, well, Lucy rather hypothesizes that Zorobnix has been turning these other Trell into like his own personal bionic army.
Rosto thinks, right, I'm a bit alone here, and then turns to Lucy and says, you are the most remarkable humanoid I have ever met.
Oh, really? Oh, I missed that. Nice line.
Which is fair. Probably the only one that doesn't teleport away from him.
I guess so. No, she's... okay, anyway.
Cut to Khan, and, you know...
Not yet. We cut to the Doctor having a little bit of a chit-chat with his sisterhood of teleporting plants.
Sorry. That was what I meant to say.
Okay, oh, sorry. In that case, take it away.
I thought it was on Khan, but it isn't.
It's not?
No, it definitely isn't. So, Athena starts talking to the Doctor and says, many, many stories have been passed down through the generations about you, which places this significant number of years after Brain and Morbius.
Yeah.
And they say he's a prattling man full of idle questions, which, to be fair, is exactly the right description of Tom Baker's Doctor.
Yeah, but we know that it's a ton of time afterwards.
And
do we know? I think so.
Yes, but this definitely puts it generations after.
Okay.
We are not talking like it's 20, 30 years. This is generations after where the Doctor has gone into legend.
Okay, all right, okay, fair.
Basically, at that point, she points to the portal to Oblivion.
Which is ridiculously dramatic. But fine, yeah. There's a door, he goes, oh, where do you think that door leads? I have a feeling you're gonna tell me. Oblivion. Cut to, or fade to, Hespera's ship, where an alarm is sounding because all of a sudden they're locked in some sort of tractor beam and they're being pulled towards Khan. And then, just as...
A wheezing, groaning sound appears.
Yeah.
And then our second least favourite Time Lord in the world materialises.
Straxus! Yeah, he time rings aboard. And then cut back to, there is such an endless back and forth, but cut back to the Doctor all of a sudden realizing that what this Oblivion entails is a molecular dispersal chamber that the Sisterhood of the Teleporting Pants stole from the Time Lords. And Athena tells him, listen, check it out, dude Meister, Lucy is in mortal danger. I'm going to pop you inside that molecular dispersal chamber if you refuse to save her. So,
and the molecular dispersion chamber the Doctor has already been in once before.
Oh, really?
And it it was switched on.
Oh, really? Where?
It was in the episode, the Peter Davison episode, Arc of Infinity, and he was actually saved by the renegade Time Lord Omega.
Ooh.
From being molecularly dispersed.
Wow.
As I said, literally everything in this is a previous episode.
Well, apparently so. Anyway, so now his choice is either he gets molecularly dispersed or he saves Lucy. So it kind of seems like a win-win situation. Kablamo, Lucy has now stolen Straxus's time ring, I think, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and Straxus just wants it back so that they can get the heck out of Dodge, but he doesn't give a damn about Rosto as long as they get away from Khan.
What we have is the IR Sisterhood basically turn around and go, we've tried to teleport Lucy, doesn't work. They know where Lucy is. The old woman says Lucy is still on board.
But she's approaching Khan. She can sense that she's close to Khan.
She is approaching Khan.
Yeah.
As they departed it many, many years ago.
Yeah, and at this point in the audiobook, all we can really assume about Khan is that it's a pretty gnarly place.
Yeah.
We have no details. Anyway,
On the ship, basically, Straxus is blaming the Doctor for every single thing short of the Big Bang.
Yes, exactly.
And we find out that the Time Lords were trying to time scoop the Doctor.
Yeah.
And basically she says, well, why didn't you just, use your time ringy thing, appear on board the TARDIS and ask nicely?
Yeah. Sorry to cut you off, but this is basically where the two bullet point lists of what's happening on Hesperus Winnebago and what's happening with the Sisterhood of Teleporting Pants, those two bullet point lists merge and turn into one big blob, because as Straxus is saying, listen, I will time ring the heck out of here with both of you, with both you and your centipede buddy, if you just give it back to me right now, because we cannot go to Khan. As he's saying this, Kablamatron, the Sisterhood of Teleporting Pants, with the aid of the Dockmeister, dematerialized Lucy. So now Lucy is heading off, and as in, she's now going back to the dock, and Straxus and Rosto are being tractor beamed down to Khan.
Yes, and Lucy's got the time ring when she got teleported out, so they can't escape the ship. And
we have a very short-lived happy end to this episode.
We have a happy end. Lucy Miller and the Doctor are happy, but unfortunately, now that they're both here, they're going to put them into the portal to oblivion.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are recording this episode of Who Back When over Skype, and I just want you to imagine that every single time that JD says portal to oblivion, he turns to his right and points as though towards destiny. It is fantastic. That concludes part one of this two-parter. That was the Sisterhood of the Teleporting Pants.
Yeah, and okay, we mark these as one episode, but a little mini-review of part one here.
Okay.
Because part one and part two are actually two very, very different stories.
Yes, they are.
They're incredibly linked, obviously, but yeah. They're two very different stories. And I think part one is not quite as good as part two. I think part two is excellent.
I agree. I think both of them are excellent. I think both of them are great. But yes, part two is the stronger one.
The problem we have with part one is I enjoyed it.
You're right, that is a problem.
But I enjoyed it for a different reason, because I was just doing spot the reference to all the Doctor Who stories.
Okay.
It is slightly too reliant on knowing what Khan and who Morbius is. We needed to know a bit more about Morbius in order to get the last few seconds of suspense. So, around the cult of Morbius.
Mm.
Because when Straxus says Zardognix bought the planet because he's the leader of the cult of Morbius.
Yeah, that should be like a da-da-da.
That should have been a really powerful moment.
Yeah.
But you don't really have had any explanation of who Morbius is. So someone listening to this who is not familiar with Brain and Morbius is like, yay, there's someone called Morbius and this guy is the leader of his cult. Rather than, oh God. So, but ultimately, it's got Alexander Siddig and Catriona Olsen. So
True. It
gets good points for that. But I think part one suffers from having a little bit too much self-referential Doctor Who without explanation.
Okay. Well, speaking as someone who doesn't know all of these references, as in, rather, doesn't recognize all of these references, the knowledge that I had beforehand going into this was, yes, I knew about Khan, because because of the 50th anniversary, basically. And I sort of know of Morbius, but really only as this weird memory from my childhood, but also really more as part of lore, as in L-O-R-E, not L-A-W, pardon my pronunciation, Doctor Who lore, because The Brain of Morbius is a classic episode, or it's a classic serial, but I couldn't tell you. I'm not in a position to tell you the plot of Brain of Morbius. I will be three Doctors from now when we're going through that. But even so, I absolutely loved this first episode. I thought it was awesome. There are a few bits where you go, okay, well, now you're just bullet pointing things. But it genuinely doesn't matter. And I only viewed this as part one of a two-part whole. And as such, I absolutely freaking loved it. It's massively action-packed. There are so many characters. There's so much going on at the same time. And we get so many different races. We have the Trell, we have the Time Lords, we have the Sisters of the Teleporting Pants, we have Zarodniks, we have the Doctor, and we have Lucy. It is crazy.
Okay, but I think you might have taken slightly too much away from my commentary about how much I thought it needed a few more bits of explanation.
Okay.
Okay, if you were giving a score to part one, what would you give it?
Okay, you know what? Ladies and gentlemen, you're going to have to wait until the end of our review of part two to hear my score, but I would give part one...
Okay, maybe you didn't actually misjudge it. I've given it a...
I'm giving part two.
No!
Yeah, which is going to bring it down to a...
Wow,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So what do you say before we move on to part two? Shall we maybe have a word from our sponsors?
Damn those sponsors making us put these into adverts.
Sponsors!
Hello, lady and or gentleman. Really sorry to interrupt the podcast, but there's something very cool that I'd like to talk to you about. What's that, you ask? Oh, well, in that case, I shall tell you right away. I want to talk to you about Who Back When, a Doctor Who podcast that reviews not just Classic Who and New Who, but the Doctor Who audiobooks as well. Wait, what? You're listening to it right now? Whoa there, it is freaking amazeballs how on the same wavelength you and I are. Seriously, let's get hitched. No, I'm kidding. I am really grateful that you're listening to the show, though, and this is, what, halfway through the episode, maybe? So it can't be that bad, eh? Well, then what are you waiting for? Please, if you haven't already, then like us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/whobackwhen, all in one word. Subscribe and rate us on iTunes, and if you like, leave a review there as well to let others know what you think of us. Sweet buttery Moses, your iTunes review would make me so mega super duper chuffed. If you knew how happy it would make me if it only made me half as happy as it actually would, then even that would blow your mind whole. Oh my word, just thinking about it makes me want to sing. Okie dokie, thank you in advance. Sorry again for the interruption. Now on with the show. Kablamo.
And we thank our sponsors for their ongoing support of Who Back When.
This is like ITV.
Part 2.
The Vengeance of Morbius. Right, so...
Okay.
The Doc and Lucy are being put into the Portal to Oblivion. And basically he says, right, come on, right, I've done everything you wanted. Well, frankly, you were in the episode for 5 minutes, so I doubt that. It's just totally James Bond villain, this scene, and give me 5 minutes to let me figure out a way out of this trap, and...
Tell me what the entire story is about.
Tell me your master plan is.
Yeah.
And strangely, for someone who's been in every story of Doctor Who ever, Catriona Olsen basically does.
Yeah, she totally does.
She starts doing this. She reveals that Zardodnik.
Is that his name?
No, you're right. Zarodniks. Okay. I'm totally Tom Moderwalking that. and basically is the leader of Morbius's cult.
Yeah, exactly.
And the Doctor then gets quite shocked that Straxus had turned up and briefed Lucy.
Yeah, he tells Lucy who Morbius is. She tells him who Zarodniks is. He finds out that they met Straxus and blah, 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 blah. All of a sudden, Khan is part of the picture.
Yes, and basically we get the exposition that last episode sorely needed, where we find out that Morbius was in fact a Time Lord who wanted to take over the universe. Lucy quite practically says, well, can't see the problem, he's dead. And Morbius, we've obviously was in Brain of Morbius, where he was a brain in a jar, quite literally.
Yeah.
He actually destroyed the civilization on Khan. He basically went to Khan originally to steal the Sisterhood's elixir of life. And the reason he did that was because he promised all of his followers basically eternal life. so he had to go and grab it from Khan. And he was president of the Time Lords, Morbius.
Okay.
And basically, he wanted the Time Lords to use their vast godlike powers to take over the galaxy.
All right. Right. Okay. Crap, I'm looking forward to rewatching that. Is it now or is it later that Lucy devises her Jurassic Park theory?
I think it's...
It might be later, actually.
I think it's a little bit later.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, right, yeah, because now we have a cutscene of Zed's dead.
Yep.
Yeah, Zed's dead is in a lift going down to level -1087, where the main laboratory is located. And we learn that the latest experiment that he's conducted, or that his bionic centipede minions have conducted, was a success. So now the ship is, it's still being tractor-beamed, it's about to land. Straxus is sweating buckets and shitting bricks, and I'm pretty sure that there's like this weird radio call as Zed's dead is entering the laboratory. He gets a call saying like, oh, we almost have the ship. So he gets a call, it's like, basically, we have the ship, and he goes, oh, don't worry about it, just blow them out of the air. And that's, well, essentially that's it.
And basically we cut back and Hesperia totally calls the Doctor on his shit and says, well, you're playing for time now.
Yeah, I am done goldfingering you.
Yes, so Catriona Olsen turns around and says, okay, Doc, right, you fought Morbius before and you killed him.
Mm-hmm.
So before you go to the portal to oblivion... Let's totally tell you what the hell the plot is. So the Zarodniks people basically got rid of the Sisterhood from Khan.
Mm-hmm.
They strip mined the planet.
Yep.
They found out when they'd moved to their new planet that Zarodniks was basically a Morbius fanboy and had spent his entire life on eBay buying up every Morbius credit card, every Morbius signature that there was. And Hesperia was told, go to the Zarodniks Corporation and find out what the hell's going on. And she did. She found out that Zarodniks was planning to revive Morbius. We now cut to the ship.
Okay.
We have Rosto and Straxus.
Yeah.
Basically, Straxus is having an asthma attack. And
so, yeah, exactly. Right, the $6 million trail, they're kablamoing through the hull of the spaceship.
Yeah, and Straxus is basically, at this point, almost crying into one of Rosto's 99 legs.
Yeah. And Rosto does not... He is not on top of things for very long, because the $6 million trails, they inject him with bionic nanites and basically turn him into one of these minions. And they Time Lord nab Straxus.
Yeah, and then we go back to the Sisterhood.
Yeah.
And
they are basically still knee-deep in the Revelation trope. Like, they're still telling everything about everything.
Yeah, and it was the Doctor's turn now, because the Doctor basically gives you the exposition from the end of Brain of Morbius.
Bingo, okay.
Right, the Brain of Morbius basically fell into a deep, dark canyon, and there is no part of him that could possibly have ever survived, which is, you know, ultimate final last words.
Yeah, by the way, sorry to interrupt you there, but ladies and gentlemen of podcast land, I don't know at what point in space and time you're listening to this episode, but if you look around and you see, let's say, 2016 or 2017, you know what? I urge you to have a listen to our review of The Brain of Morbius, which will hopefully have been recorded by then.
So Catriona Olsen basically turns around and goes, well, I don't know what the fuck Zarodniks is doing, but he's been trying to find a Time Lord.
Okay.
So the Yahoo Sisterhood basically told the Time Lords, who stuck Gallifrey behind its transduction barriers, brought all the TARDISes back home,
yeah,
and then used the completely evil technology of the Time Scoop that they would not use under any circumstances ever to track down any Time Lords who didn't respond to their hailing signal to come back home.
Okay.
So now that's how Zarodniks found the TARDIS.
Right.
But Hesperia now says, right, now that we've given you the entire plot, it's time to execute you.
Yeah,
again.
Let's pop you in the molecular...
Portal to Oblivion!
Okay, yes. So, tell me where in my notes I should be reading, JD. Where are we?
Well, basically...
Yes, they're popped in the... Sorry, hang on, wait. I think I've eureka'd it. So, they're popped in the chamber. They're having this little chit-chat. Lucy and the Doc is like, oh my god, we're gonna die. Doc starts crying out. She thinks it's very undignified. Then she remembers, holy shitballs, she's got Straxus' ring. The Doc starts... Sorry, I'm now bullet-pointing this. The Doc starts activating the ring, tries to get them out of there. It doesn't work. parts, it tampers with their machinery.
It becomes a... Well, it doesn't become anything. It's not a portal to anywhere at this point.
Yeah. It slows down the machine long enough for the Doctor to cry out, as in to shout through the walls of the molecular dispersal chamber thingamajiggy, oblivion, whatever, that Zarodnyx already has a Time Lord.
Because he's figured out, yeah, they've got Straxus.
Yeah, exactly. So at which point...
doesn't care about me. There's no point in executing me because he already got one.
Exactly. At which point Orsina and What's-Her-Face turn off the machine.
So, anyway, they basically all become friends.
Yeah, and this is where we get the Jurassic Park theory. Essentially, what they now realize that Zarodnyx is trying to do is to use Lucy's phrase here. He is trying to Jurassic Park the situation. He is trying to make up for the fact that he doesn't have a complete Time Lord, as in a complete Morbius, by taking whatever part of Morbius he must have found on Khan and popping it into the genes of a different Time Lord, i.e. Straxus.
So the Yahoo sisterhood basically start chanting their teleportation ritual.
Yep. Doesn't quite work, though.
It doesn't work. But he says, right, I know what we can do.
We're going to jump in the TARDIS.
We're going to jump in the TARDIS and get the fuck out of here. Back in Zarodnyx's bondage chamber, Straxus is basically going, you know, just stop this. Morbius is evil. You don't want to do this.
Also, for those of you wondering out there in podcast land, this is not the same bondage chamber set up by Catriona Olsen. This is a different one.
Are you sure?
I hope so.
Zarodnyx now gives us the only bit of where he might not be evil, he might just be crazy, when he turns around and goes, well, I don't believe Morbius's reputation, I believe it's all propaganda.
Yeah.
He picked up a few things across the years, including Morbius's Time Lord presidential robes.
But so that's just a cutscene, right?
That's another cutscene. And, you know, all these cutscenes are basically, you know, trying to build some pace here. And it's basically Straxus strapped to a table crying.
Yeah, and it actually sounds genuinely painful. It sounds awful. So awful.
If it had been a character we liked on the table, we'd probably care a little bit more.
Yeah, but I have to say, I mean, I dislike Straxus quite fervently, but you cannot help but empathize. He's in quite a significant amount of pain.
Yeah.
Okay, so Kablamatron. Doc and Lucy are now going to pop back into the TARDIS, and they kind of struggle for a moment with this. Like, should they, shouldn't they, should they, shouldn't they? And what they maybe ought to avoid is to cross their own timeline. You and I have had a conversation about this on Who Back When before, where I actually asked you, sorry to cut you off, I asked you exactly what Lucy asks the Doctor. What the shit, man? We have a time machine. Let's just go back and fix this.
Well, this is our relationship. You are Lucy and I am the Doctor.
I just saw a very strange promo poster for Who Back When in my head.
So did I, and it was terrifying.
It's okay, I've got a blonde wig.
And clothing from Primark. So,
how dare you? Anyway.
Basically, we can't go back in time to before this all happened because it's already happened and we're already there.
Yeah. But they decide, you know what, F it, let's do it anyway. And we get a kind of a weird callback to the beginning of Sisterhood of the Flame, because they say, oh, wait, hang on, maybe we actually already have done this, because in the beginning, in the very beginning of part one of this two-parter, the TARDIS kind of died, and everything just shut down for a moment, and very possibly this was a consequence of them having crossed their own timeline.
And then the black hole appears again and swallows them.
Yeah.
Before they can enact their master plan.
Yeah, so now they are black holing off to Gallifrey to have a catch-up with Bulek. Doesn't matter. Cut back to Straxus and the Zedmeister, and the experiment is now over, and basically this is where the audiobook sort of takes its inspiration from Weird Science, because all of a sudden there's like this gene cupboard, and the doors open, smoke kind of settles, and out steps a voluptuous fembot. No, I wish. Out steps Morbius. And that's pretty much it. So now cut back to the TARDIS.
We would almost, but he does actually have a line.
Okay, yeah, sorry.
He is Morbius, which means that I get to point out who this is played by.
Who is it?
So this is played by Samuel West. Now, Samuel West played the part of Sirion in the abomination of nature that is Dimensions in Time. The Children in Need special, which basically shat all over the legacy of Doctor Who. Fucking ridiculous piece of crap shit that it was. Oh, and Samuel West is also the son of Timothy West, who plays Kai Tobias in Phobos.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, let's not escape from dimensions of time. In the first of the Rawmeisters episodes, and yeah. he was obviously telling us where he started listening to watching Doctor Who.
Yes.
And he mentioned that one of the things he saw was in the Wilderness Years, which you incorrectly...
I thought at first it was the movie, but it wasn't the movie.
It wasn't. It was Dimensions of Shit.
So that's what he saw? Oh,
yes. It was the Children in Need special, and I was on the floor rolling around in pain and suffering while listening to that. And he quite rightly derided it in that episode, and something which Rory, if you're listening to this, cannot help but agree with you. Basically, it was the last appearance of John Pertwee as the Third Doctor, because he died not long after. It had all the companions, all the Doctors in, with no plot, filmed on the set of EastEnders, with half the EastEnders cast. It had Kate O'Mara chewing the scenery. The plot was ridiculous. The homoerotic subtext with Sirion was just ridiculous. He was wearing leather bondage gear, so he was probably beyond in Catriona Olsen's bondage cupboard. it had a plot line that looked and felt like it was written by a three-year-old that had a crayon and was rubbing out half the crayon things with its stupid, ridiculous plot that made no sense. And ultimately, it was abysmal. And if you get a chance to watch it, don't.
You know what? I smell a bonus episode in the future.
No. Well,
yes.
Maybe you do. Maybe you do. But yes. you're doing it yourself. Because there is no physical way I will willingly put myself watching this abomination of nature.
Fair. No, that's totally fair. I don't mind doing it with Rory. Very possibly the Rawmeister just needs to face his demons and have a look at this episode again.
Well, good luck to him.
Yeah, yeah.
And because I have wrists and they are not yet slit. Meanwhile, back in the TARDIS.
Back in the TARDIS, they're waiting to pop off to Khan when all of a sudden the Trell arrive and they attack Gallifrey. How often is Gallifrey ever attacked?
The invasion of time, where it was attacked by the Sontarans, followed by the Vardons. In the Three Doctors, where it was attacked by Omega from the Antimatter universe.
I take it back then.
Where it was attacked by its own High President. Ark of Infinity, where it was attacked by Omega again. And Dave, Doctor, and the entire Time War, where it was attacked
by
Jack.
Wait, the Time War, obviously, I know of, but okay, fine. I take it back. And also, just to clarify, if anyone out there in podcast land thinks that JD is reading this off Wikipedia, I can attest to the fact that as he was listing all of these episodes, he was rolling his eyes, staring occasionally at the ceiling, occasionally trying to catch a glimpse of his own optic nerves. This was not Wikipedia. This came straight out of his brain hole. I bow to your superior knowledge, sir.
Meanwhile, the Trell are attacking Gallifrey,
yep.
But they transduction barriers, which are these shields around Gallifrey.
Yeah, but they're basically, they're not trying to attack it. Yeah, they're essentially just trying to get their attention because they want to relay this WhatsApp message from Morbius. And we get to listen in a little bit behind the scenes. It's as though someone... It's basically reminiscent of when Ellen DeGeneres was hosting the Oscars the last time and she forgot that her microphone was on while she went backstage. Because we now hear Morbius going like, can they hear me? Is this on? Are we recording? And yeah.
And basically when he doesn't get a response back, he thinks that they are weak and feeble.
At which point Doc jumps in and just delivers one liner after one. Liner.
This is a super... Bear in mind, the Doctor was in the last episode for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
But he's coming back with a vengeance here.
Yeah.
I think that the Doctor's first line to Morbius here deserves a soundbite.
Soundbites.
Sorry, we were just finishing off a particularly good jigsaw puzzle. Very bad to break the concentration, you know?
I know you.
Yeah, sorry, the High Council were a bit too busy to talk to you. It's just me, Bulek, and Lucy. Please leave a message after the bleep.
Morbius turns around and goes, ah, I remember you. Didn't you kill me?
Yeah. This is now where we start getting callbacks to part one as well, to the very beginning of part one. Morbius, you see, is wearing this sort of pimp medallion, which the Doctor identifies as the remote activator for a stellar manipulator, which is the exact same device that at the very beginning of the Sisterhood of the Teleporting Pants, he was saying, oh, but there was only one of them, and it was destroyed years and years ago. Turns out, there isn't just one manipulator in the universe. Guess again, Doc. Morbius has one, and he starts siphoning energy from the Eye of Harmony.
And they will be left without the power of time travel, and basically the Trell can come in through the transduction barriers.
Yeah, exactly. So now Doc and Lucy, they plan to go back to Khan and, well, to go back to Khan before all of this happened, as in crossing their own timelines in order to stop the Zedmeister.
Which the Doctor should know won't work, but, you know, he's running out of ideas at this point.
Yeah, but also Lucy just doesn't want to procrastinate anymore, which leads me into the next thing. Let's please have a soundbite in which Lucy and the Doc drop a few nice words. Soundbite.
Soundbite.
And this time, no pussyfooting around. We go right back to before all this happened and nobbles are up next.
Precisely, no pussyfooting, just knob.
So, what we have here is an enemy who has been really shown to be not that much of an enemy ever before. Morbius was this dictator, apparently, but that's only in stories. The last time we saw him, he was a brain in a jar defeated by a battle of wits with Tom Baker.
Yeah, you know, but you know what I think this is? This is essentially the same kind of transformation, the same kind of metamorphosis that most bad guys go through in reboots X amount of decades later. Like, if you look at the Joker, if you look at the Jack Nicholson Joker, or even, like, the TV series classic Joker, and then you look at Heath Ledger Joker, it's the same character, but all of a sudden he's gone from clownish nemesis to an actual grim, hardcore badass.
Okay, that is actually a really brilliant way of describing it. I will bow to that one. I think
that's what's happened, because like now we wouldn't be content with a brain in the jar who's just kind of a slapsticky bad guy.
It would be Brain and Morbius meets Keys and Marinus all over again. So
yeah,
and the Morphiton brains. Anyway, so the Doc and Lucy basically now leave Gallifrey.
Yeah,
but the TARDIS starts blowing up.
Yeah, as the stellar manipulator starts tearing the heart right out of the TARDIS. Kablammo, it materializes inside a cell. And there's a dude in this cell, and he's wearing a cowl, and yes, it is Straxus.
Obviously, something's really fucked up with the TARDIS, because we hear an announcement from a Trell saying that Lord Morbius has come back from a big battle, victorious.
Yeah, so it turns out it's been a decade since Morbius took over. So he's basically spent 10 years eating energy straight out of Straxus and just killing civilization after civilization, taking over the galaxy.
Morbius isn't stable.
Yeah, Park slicing wasn't quite as successful as they had hoped.
So basically, every time he weakens, he has to go and suck more of Straxus.
Yeah. He's essentially turned Straxus into a Harkonnen cat.
Yes, and placed him in the bondage cupboard.
Yes. Which really reminds me I have to rewatch Dune ASAP. Anyway.
So Zarodnik basically kowtows before Morbius, and Morbius goes, had enough of you, go on, bring up Straxus, I need to suckle on him.
Coincidentally, obviously, just as Doc and Lucy have appeared here, not only has Morbius just returned from another successful campaign, he's just, literally just returned from taking over the Earth. What a coincidence. But we do get a nice little bit of dialogue here where he explains, oh, they had this really neat little statue called the Statue of Liberty, and I thought it looked really nice on the roof of my palace, so I've got a few million human slaves putting it up there right now.
He also says that when I come back from a battle and I'm tired, I like to go out on this balcony and look down at the place where my brain fell a few millennia ago.
Yeah.
Totally crazy.
Yes. Yes, very crazy.
So, the in the cell...
Yeah, I'm sorry.
In the cell, the Doc and Lucy talk to Straxus and say, is he still wearing the remote stellar manipulator around his neck?
What? Duh, obviously he is. These pimp necklaces, they never go out of style. He is obviously, 10 years later, still wearing it around his neck.
Lucy confirms that if they can switch off the remote stellar manipulator, Gallifrey will get all of its magic back and they can travel back in time and head into the Quantum Leap Accelerator and put things right when they once went wrong.
Yeah. Who wears a remote control around their neck, by the way?
Morbius.
Anyway, yeah. Before they move on to the next bullet point, there is one tiny bit where the Doctor tries to contact the Sisterhood of the Teleporting Pants. And he does so by, what does he do? He turns on the telepathic circuits in...
Of the TARDIS.
Of the TARDIS. Okay, sorry, you said this, didn't you? I'm sorry. But he essentially tries to telepathically Skype the Sisterhood, but it's a one-way thing. He doesn't know if they're picking up the call. He doesn't know if it's actually going through. But he is betting 100% of the future of the universe on this one call going through. And meanwhile, Lucy is having a chit-chat with Straxus about Rostow. Because Rostow, remember him, the centipede police dude? Turns out he's the guy who always comes to fetch Straxus for the feeding, and he is still, 10 years later, freaking obsessed with Lucy Miller, from which we can deduce what? I think he's got a massive crush on her. Yes, yes, exactly. No, you're not getting away with that. Ladies and gentlemen, he just... JD just pantomimed the massive bust of Lucy over Skype. Yeah, absolutely. He's got a massive trail hard on for her. Because even now, even though he's bionicked up to the hilt, he is still only ever saying two words, namely Lucy Miller, every time he sees Straxus.
And back in the TARDIS, the Doc sends out his message and he says that, right, I'm going to go and kill myself.
Yep.
I'm going to go and switch off the remote stellar manipulator, but you need to, you know, use your teleporting pants magic to get me away immediately, or Morbius will kill me and just, you know, press a button on the remote control.
Yeah, exactly. Then we get a little cutscene of Hespera being a total B-word, in which she says, well, who cares? Like, it doesn't matter. If he dies, all the better, right? That's pretty much it. And then we go back to the cell where Doc is now being introduced to Rostow.
Rostow does turn to Lucy and indeed call Lucy Miller.
Yeah.
This has been 10 years. The last thing he was thinking about when he got injected was Lucy. So he has kept thinking about her. Which is, to be honest, I think poor Rostow. I actually do think poor Rostow at this point.
I feel so bad for him. I mean, we spent the entire Sisterhood of the Flame liking this character.
Rooting for him.
Absolutely adoring this character, and now he's turned into this bionic zombie. So,
yeah, a bit sorry for him.
Yeah, very sorry. Anyway, we now see the Zedmeister mega weakened, chatting about the lack of Time Lords in the universe. Like, where the hell are the Time Lords? Calls for Straxus. A robed man turns up before him and he goes, I want to look at your rotting Time Lord face as I suck the energy out of your body. Removes the cowl, bada bing, bada boom, tis not Straxus, tis the Dockmeister.
And everyone's a little bit shocked here, so basically he uses the shock to grab the remote control for the stellar manipulator. Morbius goes, no, kill him!
Yeah, but we have this massive action sequence in which Lucy, Straxus, and Rostow turn up and just Jason Statham into the room, start Steven Seagaling all of the guards. Doc and Morbius are wrestling. They approach the balcony, and Doc's now, I mean, he's got the remote, right? He's taken the remote, and...
Basically, the Doctor is trying to telepathically contact the Sisterhood again.
Yeah, exactly, and apparently fails, right?
But they totally Reichenbach falls onto the balcony.
Yeah. Really? Is that what you're getting at? I'm getting Babylon 5 vibes. I'm thinking this is incredibly reminiscent of the Season 3 climax in Babylon 5.
Jump. Jump now.
Oh, I love Babylon 5 so much. Okay.
So literally, the Doc and Morbius are on the balcony. The White Star is right heading towards the planet. And they literally Reichenbach falls off. The two of them go over the balcony and That's it.
Yeah, it's almost Morbius doing this, right? He says, like, well, if I'm going down, then you're going down with me, grabs a hold of the Doc and throws them both over the balcony.
Yes, because the Doc has a remote telemanipulator in his hand. Without that, the Time Lords are coming back anyway.
Exactly. So he might as well kill his nemesis while he's at it. Kablamatron, they fall over, they apparently die, and then the Time Lords, now having access to their Time Lord technology once again, start correcting the flow of time.
And they wibbly-wobbly timey-wimey back to Khan before the Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants left.
Exactly. And now Khan, like, it has the sound of this lush forest planet. Bulik suddenly appears, basically says, you know what, there's no saving the Dockmeister. And is Traxxas also there? Yeah, he is also there, yeah. And the two of them essentially, like, I mean, Lucy is utterly heartbroken. She has now lost the Doctor a second time over the course of this double episode. I mean, the first time being when the $6 million Trell kidnapped him and she was Shawshanking, and now when they've Reichenbacked. So now Straxus and Bulik offering to Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind her and make her forget all about the Doc and their adventures.
Because Ferris Bueller does turn around and go, everything has been reset except for the Doctor's death, because the Doctor's death is what allowed this change of history to happen.
Exactly, it was integral. They cannot save him. Even though she does reason that, well, if they were ready to break a few more of their Time Lord rules, then they would probably be able to save him.
So basically she then, you know, she's quite happy to jump off the canyon at this point.
Yeah. They talk her off the ledge and she just goes, you know what, take me home.
Yeah, had enough now, go home. And that's the end of Doctor Whoever.
Yeah.
Scores.
Roll credits. We think it's the end. It is not the end, because there is a fantabulous freaking post-credit sequence.
Yes, it's nighttime. Lucy's back at home. She's shopping in Primark. She's asleep in bed after a day's miserable shopping.
The doorbell rings.
And rings and knocks and rings.
She goes up to answer the door and is all of a sudden faced with
the
headhunter.
Headhunter basically does what she always does when she meets Lucy and has a gun with her.
Yeah. Wait, hang on. Ladies and gentlemen, if you don't know who the headhunter is, go to Who Back When and type in headhunter in this as a search term and you'll find a bunch of episodes in which she turns up. Please have a listen to Human Resources. Let's get back to this one.
Absolutely. But basically, the headhunter says, right, if you make a move, I'll kill you. Lucy
starts screaming.
And the headhunter shoots her.
Yeah, because she even says, like, talking counts as moving.
And I actually think that the last 15 seconds of this episode...
bumps it up.
Well worth a soundbite.
Soundbites?
It's soundbites.
Here we go.
Blimey, it's you. Never thought I'd see you again. Hey, there's no need for...
If you make another move, I'll kill you.
But what...
Speaking counts as moving, Lucy Miller.
What? No, you can't be serious. No!
Well, Catriona Olsen, you've done quite well this episode. You've played two different paths.
Yeah, not the first time.
No, not the first time. And that is the end of season two. And it leaves it on a cliffhanger with the Doctor dead and Lucy being...
kidnapped.
Shot.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Not necessarily kidnapped. Very possibly dead. Very probably not. Oh, my God. Do you want to do your mini review first?
Okay.
Reviews.
Sisterhood of the Flame, I thought was quite good.
Okay.
It relies a bit too much on knowing who Morbius is.
Okay.
And it relies too much on continuity. And then Vengeance of Morbius turns up, which is amazingly good.
Yeah.
The entire way it is resolved is actually internally consistent. It is incredibly fast-paced. It moves along at an incredibly great pace. Morbius is shown to be a threat without actually being on screen for more than 30 seconds.
Mm.
Ultimately, taken as a two-parter, it is very slightly less than the sum of its two parts, due to Sisterhood of the Flame relying a bit more on what was going to happen in part two. The combined two episodes, I would give a 4.32. Then it has a post-credit sequence, which does take it up to 4.4.
Yeah.
So I would give this a 4.4. It is well recommended. It is a great story. It is obviously required before you watch Orbis. But this comes in as my second highest Doctor Who story. It's just slightly less than Human Resources.
Very nice. Well, you know, spoiler alert, people. Well, spoiler alert before. We've already shared our scores with each other. As you may recall, we bleeped them earlier on. I'm going to have to summarize what I said before one more time. Sister of the Flame, it really didn't bother me that I didn't know all of these trivia bits. And if anyone out there is thinking, well, holy crap, like I am not as au fait as far as Doctor Who is concerned as JD, fret not, ladies and gentlemen. No one is. No one knows as much about Doctor Who as JD. And I certainly don't. Oh my goodness, I certainly don't. But I still managed to thoroughly enjoy Sister of the Flame. Score-wise, I'm giving Sister of the Flame 4.7. Now, I never viewed that as a standalone episode. I always viewed it as part one of a double episode. And I've listened to these two episodes back-to-back, I think 3 or 4 times. And I never listened to either one of them on their own. I wouldn't recommend that anyone does. So if I had to give Sister of the Flame something, a score, I'm giving it 4.7. Vengeance of Morbius, Jesus balls, so bombastic, so much is going on. It's so fast-paced. I mean, I don't know how long we've done this review. I think we've been recording for like 2 hours or something. About 1 hour and 15 we spent on Sister of the Flame. Because Vengeance of Morbius, not because there's not that much happening in it, but because it's so fast-paced, there's so much action constantly. It couldn't be more entertaining as far as adventure sci-fi is concerned. And it's calling back, like you constantly have these feelings of nostalgia because it's calling back to what you heard in Sister of the Flame. So you're shaking your head. I love this. I would give Vengeance of Morbius, and I already told you this, and you completely disagreed with me, and now you're nodding your head because you agree with yourself. But I'm giving Vengeance of Morbius. I'm giving Vengeance of Morbius 5.0. This is the first time I've ever done that. Now, this is still one story as far as I'm concerned. So this now brings it down to a 4.85, which I am rounding up, obviously, to 4.9. That is 0.1, I believe, higher than I gave Human Resources. So far, I think this is the most accomplished Doctor Who audiobook that I've encountered.
We slightly disagree. I think it's slightly less than Human Resources. You think it's slightly more. Mm. Let us agree on one thing. So far, the two-parters that have occurred in the Eighth Doctor Adventures
are phenomenal.
Phenomenal.
Yeah. Oh, so, my goodness.
You know, this is the end of Season 2. We are now basically halfway through.
Yep.
And it is not going to go downhill. But we do have a listener review.
Yes, we do.
Listener minis.
So our listener review is from Gallifreyan Buccaneer.
Hello, Gallifreyan Buccaneer. How you doing, buddy?
Who has reviewed... Of course he's reviewed Sister of the Flame and Vengeance of Morbius, because that's the review that we're doing.
Gallifreyan Buccaneer writes... Thoroughly enjoyed these two stories. You have to love Big Finish to base the Grand Series 2 finale around a villain who appears in but one, in brackets, a brilliant Tom Baker story. Morbius is nothing but a threat in the entire story, menacing in voice and action and playing off McGann beautifully. Kenneth Colley acts as an excellent villain in the first part as the Imperious Zarobniks, but Morbius steals the show, played by Sam West.
The cliffhanger of the second part is one of my favourite of the entire Who canon, even if I wasn't a big fan of the resolution, which will come up in Orbis. This story is everything one could want from a Morbius story. It builds on the backstory the original, but never seems bogged down by it, creating a speedy yet tense two-parter that's a lot of fun to listen to.
And he concludes, I'd give this two-parter a 4.6.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, I gotta say, that's pretty spot on.
You know, we agree with pretty much every point.
Yeah.
And we will come on to Orbis next, and, you know, we will see what, I dare say, you think about Orbis as well.
And ladies and gentlemen of Podcast Land who are not Gallifreyan Buccaneer, please do yourselves a massive favor and improve your lives just a tiny little bit more by following him on Twitter. He is at Alan R. Trussler. That's Alan with a U.
You should follow him. I do.
So this has been Sisters of the Flame and the Vengeance of Morbius. If you feel like following us, you can follow us on Twitter. He is at Ponkin.
Say hi to me.
And I'm at Marius Kane.
That's Kane with a K.
And if you're spelling it wrong by now, you haven't listened to any of the rest of the podcast.
Like us on Facebook. We are facebook.com/whobackwhen. And please, if you're an iTunes user, leave us a rating and review.
You can go to Reddit, that's /r/whobackwhen. And please feel free to recommend the podcast on /r/Gallifrey and /r/Doctor Who. If you use Google Plus, I am feeling sorry for your existence.
But we don't judge. Follow us there as well. We're plus Who Back When. Next time, you can encounter us doing either a new Who review, namely
Aliens of London and World War III.
Yes, which we will be reviewing separately, but with a very, very short interval of time in between. If you want to catch us in a classic Who review, the next one we're doing is Galaxy 4. And we've already said it, the next audiobook review is
Orbis.
Kablamo. Thanks so much for tuning in, for listening to us for what must have been quite a while. I'm going to have a lot of editing to do here. Catch you next time. Shamalama ding dong and be rad and excellent to each other. Ciao.
Bye bye.
Who back when?